7. The constant red glow in the darkness. It was the intertwined marriage rings. Of course. For several minutes, both Holmes and James had reached up to feel around the sunken edges of the granite rings, with Holmes muttering much of the time, "This is the important side of the monument. The monument was covered with a tent for a month and a half. Who needs to protect a granite slab from the weather? Adams did everything but draw me a map and leave real arrows on the grass, showing me the way." On the first three tactile explorations, Holmes's fingers found nothing. But then he felt the slight niche, the smallest of indentations at the bottom of the 10-inch-wide right ring. "Stand back," he said to James, and retrieved a burglar's tool from his bag, a very short crowbar with a chisel's narrow end to it. It fit. There was a corresponding snap from behind the granite, and the two rings swiveled to almost right angles from the monument. Holmes pushed on one of them. A panel in the granite swiveled, opening into absolute darkness. "Good Lord!" cried James as he took a quick two steps backward, as if he feared being swallowed up by that black aperture. Before stepping in, Holmes played the narrow beam from the dark lantern into that darkness, and it was good that he had. About 14 feet inside, the floor ended, and a square hole in the floor, showing a ladder on the right side and just big enough for a man, dropped into blackness. Straight ahead, on the far side of that hole, was a strange cushioned seat one could reach by walking carefully along granite ledges on either side. The far side of the interior of the granite monument was irregular, a series of bronze protrusions and indentations. "The statue's hollow," said Holmes, his voice showing no surprise because he'd realized all this while sitting out on the bench. He put the tool back in his bag, held the bag and his walking stick in one hand and the lantern ahead of him in the other, stepped in, moved to the ladder side along the narrow strip of granite, then played the lantern beam back over the entrance. "Take care when you step in, James."
"I'm not going in there,"
said the writer. He'd kept his distance from the monument when the panel had swiveled open.
"All right," said Holmes, "but go back to the carriage waiting for us on New Hampshire Avenue. I shan't be long in here."
He started to swing shut the panel.
"Wait," said James. "I am coming in."
The portly rider stepped in with great care and balanced on the granite ledge on the left side of the hole. Holmes played the lantern beam over the inside of the portal.
"I need to make sure there's a release mechanism on the inside that does not require a key, so that we don't get... here it is."
Holmes worked the mechanism to his satisfaction, and then swung the swiveling panel shut until it clicked. They were entombed.
"The ladder first,"
said Holmes, and aimed the beam down the iron ladder driven into the granite. It had a railing and rungs and went down about 8 feet. Nothing else was visible at the bottom until he realized that the wall on the statue side of the bottom of the short shaft was actually a black curtain.
"Would you please hold the lantern with that beam playing just so until I get to the bottom?"
asked Holmes.
"No," cried James. "I mean, you can't. We must not. This is... all this down there, it's too terrible."
The last was said in a dying whisper, since this place seemed to call for whispering. Holmes looked at his companion's face in the reflected lantern light and knew exactly what James was thinking lay beyond that black velvet curtain. A glass coffin with Clover Adams's rotting remains in it. What would she look like after 7 years? Unfortunately, Holmes knew all too well what a body dead 7 years looked like. He whispered,
No, I think not, James. Your friend Adams is strange, perhaps even mad by some standards. But there's a method to this madness. I am convinced that we will find nothing terrible or gruesome down there."
He handed the lantern to James, set his bag and stick on the cushioned chair that was suspended along the far wall by a round iron post that was secured in the interior of the sculpture.
"Down just a bit," said Holmes,
and when James tipped the dark lantern forward, he clambered down several rungs.
"I'll take it now."
The tall man's white fingers reached for the metal handle atop the lantern. At the bottom, Holmes paused a moment and played the light on all sides. It was a narrow shaft, hardly broader than his shoulders, and it would have been problematic for anyone who suffered from claustrophobic panics. Holmes smiled, thinking that he must look like some archaeologist entering a newly discovered tomb in Egypt or Babylon or Troy. But there were no hieroglyphics on these three granite walls, nor switches or niches or clues, only the ladder and this black curtain. Raising the lantern and opening the shutter a little wider, Holmes pushed the curtain aside and stepped forward, making sure that there was granite beneath his feet before taking his steps.
"What do you see?"
James's voice came down the shaft in a harsh, urgent whisper.
"Just a moment," said Holmes.
The room was a rectangular prism, about 6 feet wide and 8 feet long, that had been laid under the footing for the monument sculpture and the paved and graveled hexagon above. Holmes estimated that there were probably 2 feet of solid concrete or even granite above his head, then soil. Carved into the granite to his left was a long niche about shoulder high. It was filled with books. To his immediate right, there was a granite column extending from the wall, also about shoulder height. On it was a small lantern. Holmes was tempted to light it with his prototype cigarette lighter. The resident lantern's light would be better than the beam from his dark lantern, but he wanted to be sure to leave no signs of his having been here. The rest of the granite wall to his right was carved into a larger niche, rising only some 3 feet from the floor, and on the upper surface of that niche was a narrow bed cushion with two pillows set at the far end. The whole bed was only about 6 feet long, and Holmes would have had to curl his legs up if he'd lain on it. He did not. The bed was made up neatly, and Holmes touched the blanket and sheets. Warm, not cold or moldy feeling. They must be changed regularly. Holmes would wager money that these were the only times in his 55 years of life that Henry Brooks Adams had ever made his own bed. There was a second narrow granite column at the far end and a second small lantern on it. Tucked by that lantern was a book. Holmes picked it up, it was leather bound, and played the lantern's beam over it. "The Light of Asia, The Teacher of Nirvana and the Law," by Sir Edwin Arnold. It had caused a slight stir in America and England when it was released in 1879, but Holmes had read only part of it before impatiently setting it aside. He thought Arnold's writing was insufferably prolix. Still, he remembered the review in the Times of London, written by the noted Japanologist Lafcadio Hearn, when the 1883 edition came out. After all, Buddhism, in some esoteric form, may prove the religion of the future. What are the heavens of all Christian fancies, after all, but nirvana, the extinction of individuality in the eternal? Indeed, thought Holmes. After carefully setting the book back in place above the pillows by the second lantern, Holmes stepped back through the curtain into the short vertical shaft.
"Come down, James."
"I cannot," came the whisper in return.
"You really should," said Holmes. "Otherwise you shall spend a lifetime wondering if I was telling the truth. Trust me that there is nothing disturbing here."
There came down a sound like stifled, hysterical laughter. In an urgent whisper, James said,
"Everything about this moment is disturbing, Holmes. We have invaded the deepest part of a good man's privacy, intruding into his mourning and perhaps into his madness. Our behavior is criminal, unspeakable."
"Agreed," said Holmes. "But it's done. Come down and look, and then we'll finish our business here."
"Hold the lantern higher,"
Henry James whispered, and ponderously started down the iron ladder. 5 minutes later, they were both up in the above-ground part of the monument again. The chair with its padded seat was broad enough for both of them to perch on it if each steadied himself with a leg outstretched to the granite ledge on one side.
"There's no view through the eyes," whispered James.
It was true. They were able to make out the inverted features of the sculpture's face now with the aid of the lantern beam, but although the eyes had seemed empty of bronze from casual inspection outside the piece, now they could see two oval slugs of metal, not bronze, covering those openings. Holmes had seen those non-bronze insets within the otherwise open, downcast eyes when he'd held the lantern up to inspect the sculpture.
"Look for a lever," whispered Holmes. "These plugs are attached to... Ah!"
The lever mechanism was on James's left side.
"Put your hand on it, but don't open it yet," said Holmes, his mouth close to James's ear. "Let me turn out the lantern first and let our eyes adapt to the darkness for a moment."
It was disconcerting for Holmes to spend that moment pressed so close to another man. He could feel James inching away, putting most of his weight on his left foot so as to avoid touching.
"Now,"
whispered Holmes. The shutters over the eyes made almost no noise as the metal rod above them rose, and they lifted the eye plugs out of place. Their angle of vision was good. The androgynous sculpture's head was angled forward, and the face partially sheltered by the cowl, but the eye openings were larger than life size, and, with Holmes taking the right eye and James the left, they could see the entire hexagon before them, the benches, and the stars above the enclosure of trees. The space was empty. After a moment, they both sat back. The view was still good.
"This is how Adams sees and hears people's reactions without being observed in turn,"
whispered James. Holmes nodded.
"I'm not sure that,"
began James, but silenced himself when Holmes firmly gripped his upper arm.
Someone had entered the shrub-bounded enclosure outside.
Both Holmes and James leaned forward, instinctively not putting their eyes too close to the oval openings to be sure that starlight did not cause a gleam. Holmes could not make out any detail save for the shadows of trousered legs, definitely not a woman in a dress, but the man seemed to be very tall and very thin. This impression was confirmed when he sat on the bench directly opposite the sculpture, for his shoulders were higher than the very high back of the bench, higher even than Holmes's had been when he'd sat there. James leaned over to whisper directly into Holmes's ear.
"It's not Adams."
Holmes shushed him by squeezing harder. The scrape of the man's boots or shoes against the gravel had been so audible that Holmes suspected the enclosure acted as a sort of hearing gallery, amplifying sound. He suspected that Adams had directed Stanford White to achieve that effect, thus the oddly high back of the benches and the triangle of stone. Holmes worried that any noise from within the sculpture might as easily be carried out to the open area. James intuited the message and leaned forward again. For several minutes, the man did nothing. As Holmes's eyes adapt even further to the moonless night, he could see the man's long arms spread to either side on the back of the bench, the same posture that Holmes had assumed earlier. After a few minutes of this silent staring match, the man's arms came down. Holmes could make out pale hands touching pockets of a jacket or waistcoat, clearly heard the scrape of a match, and the man leaned forward to light a cigarette. That flare of a match should have revealed the man's face, but Holmes saw only a glow with an arc of blackness cut out of it. He realized at once that the man was wearing a broad-brimmed hat of some sort, and the brim had occluded any view of his face. Had that been an accident, or coldly deliberate? Sherlock Holmes never guessed, but his hunch at the moment was that it was the latter. He and James sat there, uncomfortably perched on the same chair, hardly daring to breathe while the man smoked his cigarette. A single red glow in the darkness, no features visible, only the dot of red in the darkness. The man eventually finished that cigarette. There was a half-seen movement of pale hands, and he lit another one. Again, the downturned brim of a hat concealed any features that might have been caught in the brief flare of the match.
"He's playing with us," thought Holmes.
He hadn't expected Lucan Adler to find him so soon, but Holmes realized that he might have underestimated the speed of gossip about his presence. Gossip spreading outward not only from the Hayes and their servants and the Cabot Lodges and Camerons and Roosevelt, but from Clemens and William Dean Howells as well. Lucan was the ultimate predator, and Holmes realized with a tightening in his chest not unlike fear that he had given that predator assassin more than enough time to find him.
"Then why am I alive?" thought Holmes.
He realized that, without thinking about it, he'd slid his right hand into his traveling coat's pocket. Instead of the reassuring hand grip of a pistol, he still had not taken time to buy one here in Washington. His fingers found the short, flexible grip of the cosh, Americans called it a blackjack, that he'd brought with him. The tough leather of the working end of the cosh was filled with sand, and it was guaranteed, when used properly, to bring even the largest opponent to his knees, if not face down on the ground. In his trouser pocket, he had his folding penknife with its 4-inch blade. In his burglary bag, the short crowbar he'd used to open the monument was the closest thing to a weapon.
"The great Sherlock Holmes," thought Holmes with hot irony, overriding the stab of panic he'd felt a few seconds earlier, "brings a penknife and a cosh to a gunfight."
He had never wanted to confront Lucan Adler with Henry James at his side, but now, he felt almost certain, he had. He was almost as certain that Lucan knew that Holmes and someone else were in the monument looking at him. The red glow was extinguished. Holmes tensed, gripping the handle of his cosh. At least if Lucan entered the monument, Holmes had little doubt that the anarchist assassin had watched James and him enter it. There would be so little room that Lucan's marksmanship with a rifle or pistol would be largely negated.
"A perfect space, especially with the open shaft that Lucan might not know is there, for a fight with a knife or cosh," thought Holmes. "But with Henry James in the middle of it."
A third match flared. Again the taunt with the head downward, the large brim of a hat concealing the face. Again, the steady glow of the cigarette's end in the deep darkness of the monument's enclosure. They had sat there for more than half an hour, Holmes estimated, staring at the unknown man who was staring at them, or at least at the sculpture, which would be only a dark shape in the night. Holmes was almost certain that it wasn't Henry Adams out there. Even if he were wrong about the man's height, would Adams ever wear a hat like that? And every minute that passed made him more certain that it was Lucan Adler, playing with James and him the way a cat plays with a mouse in the minutes before biting its head off. Holmes's legs were cramping in the uncomfortable posture, but worse than that was the rising pain from his 3 bullet wounds. The one in the lower right of his back was the worst. Holmes realized that in the intensity of his brooding on Adams's mystery that afternoon and evening, he'd forgotten to take his second injection of heroin. Its absence seemed to make the wounds ache more. 10 minutes, he gauged, into the third glowing red dot, and Holmes set his mouth almost against James's ear. He could smell the expensive pomade in his hair and whispered,
"Stay here. I'm going out there."
He could feel rather than actually see James shaking his head no. But Holmes gripped him tightly on the upper arm again, repeating his instruction to stay where he was.
"Perhaps Lucan didn't actually see us enter the monument after all," thought Holmes. "If he did not, then James has a chance to survive, even if Lucan kills me."
Stepping silently on the right side granite strip, Holmes found the lantern by feel and lifted it in his left hand. He would have to light it again outside, then shutter it quickly.
But a bright beam of light shone in Lucan's face might...
He did not finish the thought, because he did not really believe it would. Taking one last glance to make sure that the figure and cigarette glow were still there, Holmes gingerly stepped over his burglary bag, found the opening mechanism by touch, and clicked it open. The click was a small noise, but it sounded as loud as a rifle shot to Holmes's anxious ears. The air that rushed in was cold, and Holmes realized how overheated the small space had become during the time that he and James had been in there, emanating body heat. Once outside, Holmes took the risk of pushing the panel shut, another intolerable click, to give James that tiny chance of survival, if this was Lucan Adler waiting. He knelt, fished his mechanical lighter from his trouser pocket in one swift movement, and lighted the dark lantern. He'd already fully shuttered the front, so the only light had been the flare of his lighter, but that had seemed interminable and visible to anyone in the cemetery. He'd looked away as he flicked the lighter and lit the lantern, not wanting to lose his night vision, but he still had to stand there half a moment and blink before he could fully see again. Holding the lantern forward in his left hand, the fingers of that hand ready to open the shutter all the way in one fast movement, Holmes pulled out the cosh and carried it by his side. Holmes walked stealthily around the right corner of the enclosure, toward the side where the cleft in the trees allowed access. No light escaped from that opening. Holmes was taking care where he put his feet, but did not want to walk too slowly. Surprise, after all, and perhaps a sudden shaft of light in Lucan's eyes were almost certainly Holmes's only hope for surviving the next few minutes. He got to the opening in the trees and stopped, finally leaning forward to put only his head forward in a fast peek around the edge. Even that movement, he knew, would be target enough for a master assassin with a pistol ready. Holmes knew that even though clouds had occluded the stars, it was still lighter outside the enclosure than within, and his head would be in silhouette. No shot. No sound. Holmes looked again, eyes straining, but could not make out the flowing cigarette or the form of the man on the bench. It was simply too dark in that enclosure now. He realized that when the clouds had come in sometime in the last 45 minutes, he and James had been watching the red glow of the cigarette rather than the dark outline of the man in the blackness. No further reason to wait, thought Holmes. Raising the lantern high, seeing nothing but darkness ahead in and beyond the entrance cleft, Holmes strode quickly forward, the sound of his brushing branches as loud as an avalanche in his ears. The instant he was through the cleft in the trees, his fingers swept open the shutter on the lantern, his right arm flexing as he hefted the cosh. The place on the bench where the man had been sitting was empty. Where had he moved? Anywhere in the enclosure would afford him a perfect shot. Holmes considered slamming shut the lantern's shutter, Lucan's sharpshooter advantages eliminated, just two men in blackness feeling for each other, and Holmes had the knife and the cosh. But he found he was too impatient for whatever the showdown would bring to follow that saner tactic. He moved quickly, in erratic patterns, holding the lantern away from his body, aiming the beam this way and then that way. The benches were empty. The graveled hexagon in front of the sculpture was empty. The area around the granite and bronze monument was empty. Behind the benches. It would have been Holmes's first choice for a hiding place if he were waiting to shoot a man here. Holmes leaped up onto the bench, and then over the high back, going to a quick crouch on the back side of the bench closest to the opening in the trees, lantern beam illuminating the narrow corridor ahead of him between the stone bench and the trees. Empty. Rushing forward, still in a crouch so that his head was below the level of the back of the stone bench, he reached the first corner and set the lantern on the ground, its aimed beam shooting to the left. No shot. No sound. Holmes looked around, saw this second corridor of space empty, saw no new breaks in the wall of foliage to his right, and he hurried to the last turn, not bothering to pause before he swept around it. He was ready to dash down the lantern in a second if he couldn't get close enough to blind his opponent with it. Nothing. Holmes came out into the opening and checked all the walls of foliage. Someone could have forced his way through the tree branches and hedges and out into the opening, but Holmes certainly would have heard him do so as he approached. Satisfied that no one else was in the enclosure, he held the lantern high again and walked toward the bronze sculpture on its two-level base. He approached it obliquely, visualizing Henry James dead, his body dropped into the vertical shaft, and Lucan's young hunter's eyes at one of the eyehole openings, and a pistol pressed against the other opening. The eyes were large enough to pass a bullet from a revolver. His cape coat brushed against foliage as he crept toward the seated, brooding, still powerful sculpture. The combination of darkness and harsh lantern light brought out the draped folds in the robe, the shadows under the cowl, the straight nose and solid chin, the upraised and folded-in right arm with its fingers disappearing under bronze cheek and chin.
James?
Holmes had used a normal, conversational voice, and the loudness of it in the thick night made him jump.
No response.
Louder.
James? I'm here,
came the oddly muffled reply from the statue's head. Holmes imagined the portly writer under duress, the muzzle of a pistol pressed under his double chin. For that matter, he hadn't been certain that the muffled voice belonged to Henry James.
What was the name of that novel of yours that I said I liked?
Said Holmes, still standing close to the right side of the monument so that he could not be seen or targeted from inside the sculpture.
What?
The echoing voice sounded more like James this time, an obviously irritated James. Holmes repeated his question.
The Princess Casamassima,
came the anger-tinged reply.
But what on earth does that have to do with anything?
Holmes smiled and stepped out in front of the cowled figure. He could not help but glance over his shoulder every few seconds.
Where is he?
He asked the statue.
I don't have the vaguest idea, Holmes.
Holmes could hear the voice better from this new vantage point, and it was definitely James's, although muffled by the bronze.
Just after you stepped out, the cigarette glow disappeared. I didn't see the man move, did not see him go out through the entrance. He just disappeared.
All right, said Holmes. I missed him then. Could you please bring my bag when you come out?
It's too dark, said James through one of the eye holes. I can't see where to put my feet. The shaft. Can't find the lock mechanism. I'll try, but...
No, on second thought, it's better that I come fetch you, said Holmes. Sit tight for just another moment and I'll bring the lantern.
But instead of going outside and to the rear of the monument, Holmes went straight across the hexagon, dropped to one knee, and began examining the graveled ground near the bench. Then he took several minutes to move the lantern close to the ground near all three benches. Then he stepped around behind the bench and did the same careful examination. He was checking the ground and the open space of the hexagon when the statue made another muffled noise. Holmes walked over to it and held the lantern high.
What was that, James?
What in God's name are you doing?
Demanded the androgynous face of deepest mourning.
Looking for the cigarettes and/or ashes, said Holmes. We watched Lucan. This figure in the dark smoke at least three cigarettes to their end. We could both smell the tobacco smoke in the darkness. But there's not a single ash or remnant of a dead cigarette anywhere. He must have dropped the ashes from the cigarettes into his palm and put the ashes and the cigarette butts in his pocket. Don't you find that odd behavior for an innocent person, James?
Damn the cigarette ashes,
said the shadow-sharpened bronze face.
Come get me out of here, Holmes. I've needed to relieve myself for more than an hour now.
The hansom and its cabbie were not there when they reached New Hampshire Avenue.
The blackguard,
cried James, referring to the driver.
That cursed driver took your money, but left anyway.
We've been a long time, said Holmes.
He'd done the entire walk from the monument with his shoulders hunched until they ached, waiting for the impact of the pistol or rifle shot whose sound he would not hear. They stayed tensed out in the open of the lightly traveled avenue. There were no street lights or house lights here.
Maybe our
smoking friend took it, said James. What do we do now?
It's only a little less than 4 miles back to Mrs. Stevens's place. So we walk, said Holmes, knowing that despite his best efforts to relax, his body would be expecting the impact of a bullet every step of the way, and for every hour and minute of the days and nights to come, until this whole matter was resolved. Some minutes later, they came to a single gas lamp on a post in the lawn of a darkened house. The light drew a yellow oval on the macadam of the road and illuminated both of them as James stopped for a second.
This is the perfect spot, thought Holmes.
Lucan in the darkness behind the house, or in the blackness under the trees to either side. His target, or perhaps targets, if Lucan was in an especially bloody mood, frozen like a deer in the beam of an illegal hunting lantern.
I somehow contrived to lose my watch, said James. What time is it?
Holmes could only hope that the author hadn't lost the watch inside the monument. Tomorrow morning, Holmes was going to let Henry Adams know that he had figured out the little mystery, been to and inside the most expensive duck blind in history. But he didn't want Adams to know about his friend James's participation. Now he set down his heavy canvas burglar bag, lifted his watch out of his waistcoat pocket by its chain, and held it so that James could see in the light.
12:15, said Holmes.
James merely nodded, lifted the bag for Holmes, and began walking again.
12:00,
thought Holmes as he caught up to the other man, macadam crunching under their soles. It was now Tuesday, the 4th of April, Sherlock Holmes's birthday. He had just turned 39 years old. 8. Wiggins, 2, arrived safely, New York, today. The morning after the absurd and disturbing melodrama in Rock Creek Cemetery, Henry James awoke with the immediate and determined resolution to do something. He just could not decide what. Return immediately to England. Go to Henry Adams with a confession and abject apologies for invading his most hidden privacy? No, no. The thought of that bed in that sarcophagus of stone under the ground on the subterranean level close to Clover's buried remains not only still gave James goosebumps, but made him slightly nauseous. He could never bring it up with Adams, nor hint in any way that he knew about the secret world inside Clover's sculpture and monument stone. Nor tell John Hay. Never. As James bathed and trimmed his short beard and dressed that rainy Tuesday morning, wishing for the 100th time that he had the Smiths, his mediocre cook and her less than mediocre tippler husband of a manservant, with him from Devere Gardens, he decided to tell Mrs. Stevens's slow-witted daughter that he would again take his breakfast in the privacy of his room. He was in the hall looking for her when the last man he wanted to see, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, looking damp and red-cheeked and in the process of shrugging off his waterproof Macintosh, was preparing to knock him up.
"Just the man I wanted to see," cried Holmes,
as good-naturedly as if they hadn't invaded a good man's mind and most sacred secret the night before.
"Come down to Mrs. Stevens's breakfast room, and we'll talk over a good breakfast."
"I was going to have mine in my room," James replied in a cool tone.
Holmes didn't seem to perceive the frost in the air.
"Nonsense. There's much we have to talk about, and very little time in which to do it, James. No, now come on down to the breakfast room like a good fellow."
"I have no intention of discussing any part or aspect of last night's events," said James.
Holmes actually smiled.
"Good. Neither do I. This is more important news. I'll see you down in the breakfast room."
And Holmes turned with one of his sudden, almost spastic, although strangely graceful moves, and bounded down the stairway, shedding rain from the Macintosh folded over his arm as he went. James paused at the head of the stairs. Should he snub Holmes now and set their relationship on the new and definitely colder and more formal level to which it needed to be adjusted? Or should he suffer hearing this more important news? In the end, James's hunger for breakfast won out over the higher moral arguments. He went downstairs.
"I have moved out of Mrs. Stevens's comfortable abode," said Holmes, eating his beans and egg and sausage and fried toast English-style breakfast, which he'd charmed Mrs. Stevens into making for him each morning.
For some reason, James was stunned. "When?" he said.
"This morning."
"Why?" asked James, a second before he realized that he did not want to know the answer, and that it was none of his business anyway.
"Things have become too dangerous," answered Holmes, almost gulping his coffee.
Usually, James had noticed, the detective was indifferent to food, but there were times, such as this morning, where he seemed to be stoking a steam engine with fuel more than merely eating.
"Whoever that man was smoking his cigarettes at the monument last night, odds are that he was someone who had followed us there with an intention to do me harm. In short, to kill me," said Holmes, eating his eggs with gusto. "My continuing to reside here would put you, Mrs. Stevens, her daughter, and everyone else around me in some danger."
"But you're not sure that the man last night was an assassin?" said James, almost stumbling over that last melodramatic word.
"No, nowhere near certain," agreed Holmes. "But for the time being, I should take no chances with my friend's well-being."
Something about that phrase, "my friends," made James feel warm inside, and he hated himself for feeling that way. He certainly had not included this Sherlock Holmes person in his rigidly vetted and constantly reviewed list of friends, and for Holmes to suggest that their association had reached that plane was pure presumption. Yet James still felt the warm glow. Holmes finished eating and lit a cigarette. The detective never ate the yolk of his fried egg, and this was one reason that James dreaded having breakfast with the man. Invariably, when finished with his cigarette, he would stub it out in the runny yolk, leaving the butt end sticking up like some artillery shell that had failed to detonate. The repulsive habit always bothered Henry James, and this morning he knew it would actively nauseate him.
"I'm not very hungry this morning,"
lied James, pushing his own plate forward and preparing to leave.
"I wish you luck in your new habitations."
"Wait, sir, wait," said Holmes, actually putting his long violinist's fingers on James's lower sleeve, as if ready to physically restrain him if the author attempted to rise and leave. "There's more I need to tell you."
James waited, but with growing anxiety, as the cigarette Holmes was smoking burned itself shorter and the runny yellow-orange egg yolk sat there amidst the debris of the eaten breakfast like a leaking bullseye. He was waiting because he wanted to know where Holmes would be, if this was indeed the last of their absurd adventure together.
"Are you going to tell me where you've moved?"
said James, shocked at his own rude bluntness.
"No. It would be better for everyone if you didn't know, James."
"Say nothing,"
James commanded himself. Several times in the last few days, he'd already stepped out of the character of Henry James, author, that he'd created over almost 50 years. Time to come back to himself again. The watcher, not the initiator. The wary listener, not the yammering fool. Still, he heard himself saying,
"Will you be leaving Washington, then?"
"I'm asking just in case Hay or Adams or someone might need to know." "If you need to get in touch with me," said Holmes, "send a note to this establishment."
Holmes clicked open his retracting mechanical pencil and wrote quickly on the back of one of his own business cards. James looked at the address. It was a cigar shop on Constitution Avenue.
"You're residing at a cigar store?"
James couldn't help from saying. Holmes made that abrupt, almost barking sound that served him as a laugh.
"Not at all, my dear James. But the proprietor there will forward any message sent to me by dispatching a boy either to my new place of residence or to send a cable. For some reason, known only to Americans, the cigar shop is open 24 hours a day. So feel free to contact me at any time."
James nodded, slipped Holmes's card into his wallet, set the wallet back in his jacket, and was about to rise again when Mrs. Stevens appeared in the doorway with a young boy in tow.
"He has a message for you, Mr. James."
She paused, perhaps reading James's expression, and added,
"I know the lad. His name is Thomas. He carries messages between some of the best homes and families around Lafayette Park. If you wish to send a reply message, I'm sure it will be safe and secure in his keeping, and unread until it reaches its source."
James nodded, interpreting her final comment to mean that young Thomas couldn't read. He beckoned the boy forward. Unfolding the paper, he saw that it was on John Hayes' private stationery.
"Dear Harry, should you like to drop around today just after tea time, say 5:15 or so, I would be pleased to discuss a most important and perhaps urgent topic with you. I look forward to seeing you then. Your obedient servant, John Hay. P.S. Please do not inform Mr. Holmes of your visit. This is very important. J.H.
Mrs. Stevens had thoughtfully brought a small stationery pad should James wish to respond. He did. Shielding his writing from Holmes's view, he accepted Hay's invitation and said that he would be there promptly at 5:15 p.m. A rather specific time, James thought. But then John Hay was a man who'd devoted his life to specifics since he'd been secretary to President Abraham Lincoln. James handed the note and a coin to the boy, saying, "Deliver this into the hand of the person who sent this message, son." Thomas might not be able to read, but there was intelligence in his eye as he nodded.
"Oh, you don't need to pay the boy, Mr. James," Mrs. Stevens was saying. "I'm sure the person who sent the message already did that."
"Nonetheless," said James, and waved Thomas away on his errand.
At that moment, two other lads were shown in by Mrs. Stevens's daughter, who looked confused at the sudden invasion of messengers. One was a boy about Thomas's age, although less well-dressed. The other, a young man in his late teens, who was wearing the livery of a Western Union delivery boy.
"Message for Mr. Holmes," said the ragged lad. "Telegram for Mr. Holmes," said the older boy.
James still thought and felt as if he were on the verge of leaving, but stayed seated out of sheer curiosity. With Holmes moved away, God knows where, he might not see the detective again. All of the tantalizing events of the past couple of weeks might forever remain a mystery. Holmes stubbed his cigarette out right in the center of the egg yolk, and James looked away to control his rising nausea. Holmes quickly read his telegram, set the flimsy on the table next to his napkin, said,
"No reply,"
to the Western Union lad who touched his cap and left, and then waved forward the other boy with the private message. This he read quickly, clutched the pad that James had used for his own reply, and said,
"I shall be back in 1 minute, James. I'll only walk our young Mercury here to the door as I scribble a reply."
Mrs. Stevens and her daughter had already left. The telegram boy was gone. Alone, James could clearly hear footsteps of Holmes and the second messenger on the parquet floor of the foyer beyond the parlor, and then the squeak of the front door hinges as they stepped out onto the porch. The obscene cigarette butt still rose from the center of the bleeding yolk. Beside it lay the telegram Holmes had forgotten near his napkin.
"No," thought James, "absolutely not."
He stood as if heading for the stairway up to his room, turned right instead of left, and opened the top fold of the telegram with his left hand. "Wiggins 2 arrived safely, New York, today. Stop. Be informed that Scotland Yard and intelligence agencies here and in France report that Moriarty's networks have been activated in Paris, Berlin, Prague, Rome, Brussels, Athens, London, Birmingham, New York City, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. Stop. No confirmation of Lucan Adler's whereabouts during past 5 weeks. Stop. Take great care. Mycroft." James quickly let the top fold of the telegram drop into place, and he walked to the stairway on the opposite side of the room as he heard Holmes's usual brisk steps on the parquet and then on the boards and braided rug in the parlor.
He was standing on the first step with one foot raised to the second step when Holmes bustled back in. Holmes noticed the telegram, folded it, and set it in his hacking jacket's pocket with the other message, without showing any signs of concern at it being read.
"So you're heading back up to your room now," said Holmes.
"Egad, Holmes," said Henry James, feeling a need to put this imitation gentleman in his place. "Your powers of deduction. How do you do it?"
Instead of showing anger or embarrassment, Holmes merely made that semi-bark of a laugh again, raised his walking stick, the one with the sword in it, James knew, and said,
"Well, then, it's cheerio for the time being, although I fully trust that our paths shall cross again before too much time goes by."
"I'm thinking of sailing for England very soon," said James. He wasn't sure why he said it, since he'd not made up his mind about any such thing.
He absently touched his waistcoat pocket, where the ivory snuff box containing his sister Alice's ashes was as firmly embedded as a tumor.
"Ah, well, then perhaps we shan't see each other again,"
Holmes said almost lightly, almost merrily, thought James with an inward glower.
"Ta-ta,"
said Holmes, and turned his back and walked briskly out of the room and to the front door, whistling some cheap music hall tune that sounded vaguely familiar to James, something he'd heard at the Old Mo on Drury Lane. James realized that he had been standing there for almost a full minute after he'd heard the front door slam shut, one foot still raised to the second step, standing like a statue of a man turned to stone by the Gorgon's stare. Worse than that, he realized that he was waiting for Holmes to come back, to say that he'd changed his mind. He wasn't moving out after all. Mrs. Stevens came into the breakfast room to clear the dishes, saw James standing there frozen on the stairway with the odd look on his face, and she was clearly startled.
"Is everything all right, Mr. James? Do you need something?" "Everything is fine, Mrs. Stevens. I was just heading up to my room to do some writing." "A good day to you, madam."
"And a good day to you, Mr. James."
She craned her neck to watch him climb the steep steps as if she'd been hired by Holmes or Mycroft or Moriarty or Lucan Adler to spy on him. James started to knock at the Hayes front door, that is, raised his knuckled fist to knock, but decided to push the newfangled electrical doorbell button instead, promptly at 5:15 p.m. It had been a hard morning and afternoon. He had tried to write, working with pencil and pad on the new play he'd promised the popular actor-manager George Alexander. But while Mrs. Stevens's boarding house was a relatively pleasant place, it was still a boarding house. Noises, loud conversations with workmen and the dull-witted daughter, the sounds of two men looking at and loudly appraising Holmes's now vacant bed sitting room, even Mrs. Stevens humming as she ironed in the little room off the kitchen, or, when his window was open, when she was hanging wash on the clothesline below after the rain had stopped, all had conspired to distract the strangely anxious and irritable Henry James. 100 times that afternoon, he had unconsciously touched the hard bulge of the ivory snuff box in his waistcoat pocket and wondered what he would do next. Go straight back to England? Go to the family burial plots in Cambridge outside of Boston and finally carry out his self-appointed duty of burying the last of his sister's ashes there? Go to join William and his family in Florence or Geneva or wherever they were off to at the moment? He could talk to William sometimes. Well, rarely. In truth, almost never. In the meantime, he was happy to have this invitation from John Hay. James felt like a man who, in leaning over a ship's railing to get a better view of something below, has fallen overboard. This invitation had felt like a life ring, complete with attached line to pull him in, tossed to him with happy, expert aim. Benson answered the bell, and after silently directing a footman to take James's wet coat, top hat, and walking cane, led the writer directly to Hayes' now familiar study, Upon looking up from a formidable stack of papers to see James standing in his doorway after being announced, John sprang to his feet, was around the desk in a minute, and used one hand to shake James's while clasping the author firmly on the shoulder with his other hand. It came close to being a hug, which of course would have horrified and appalled Henry James, but now it made him feel that glow of good feeling that he'd been certain he had lost. "I am so happy to see you, Harry," said Hay as he escorted James to the comfortable chair just opposite Hay's across the broad desk. Hay had kept in literal contact, holding James by the elbow as he walked the few paces to the chair. When James had taken his seat, Hay perched on the corner of his desk, amazingly spry for a man who would turn 55 in October, was James's thought, and not his first on that subject about Hay, and cried, "Well, it's quarter past the old Five of Hearts tea time, always precisely at 5, you know, but we can have tea anyway. Clover's ghost would not object, although we may hear a disembodied rap or two from the table there. Or perhaps some really good whiskey instead." James hesitated. It was far too early for such a strong drink for him. He rarely touched whiskey anyway. But this rainy afternoon, with the fire crackling and popping in John Hay's study's fireplace, he found the idea of a strong drink attractive, almost compelling. "Is this an honest Scotch whiskey, with no E in the word?" asked James. "Or one of your American sour mash whiskies with the E inserted?" Hay laughed. "Oh, Scotch whiskey, I assure you, Harry. I'd never offend your anglicized sensibilities with either sour mash or a sneaky, unwanted E." Hay gestured to Benson, who seemed more to dissolve in thin air than step away. "I have a 12-year-old single malt Cardew from Speyside, matured in oak casks, that I find better than most 21-year-old single malt whiskies," continued Hay, going around the desk to take his place in the high-backed and leather-tufted chair there. "Its only drawback is that one can purchase it only at Speyside, so I must either travel there each time I'm in England or constantly be paying a man to travel to Speyside, purchase it, pack it, and ship it."
"I look forward to tasting it," said James,
knowing that he'd sipped 12-year-old Cardew single malts with Paul Joukowsky, and even in Lady Wolseley's salon, the latter thanks to the tastes of her husband, Field Marshal Viscount Wolseley, the inspiration for the very model of a modern major general in Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta, The Pirates of Penzance. Even before Hay began speaking again, Benson was back with a silver tray holding the decanter of Cardew, crystal whiskey glasses, a spritzer of soda water, a pitcher of regular water, and short stack of leather coasters with John Hay's crest on them. When Benson turned toward the writer and raised one eyebrow, James said,
"Neat, please."
"The usual dash of water for me, Benson," said Hay.
When they had their whiskey glasses and Benson had left, silently closing the study door behind him, each man raised his glass. The desk was too broad for any clinking of crystal. And Hay said,
"Amicus absentibus."
James was surprised by the toast. To which absent friends exactly would they be drinking? But he nodded and drank some of the amber whiskey. It was excellent. James knew enough about judging whiskies to know that the palate on this one was smooth and well-balanced, the finish bringing out some lingering, sweet smoke in the aftertaste, but never overpowering, never showing off, as so many single malts had the tendency to do. James nodded again, this time acknowledging the quality of the whiskey, all the while thinking, which absent friend, or friends?
"Harry, I won't beat about the bush," said Hay, leaning forward and cradling his scotch glass with both hands above the papers on his desk. "Clara and I are hoping that you might consider moving back in with us for as long as you stay in Washington."
Is this related to last night?
James's heart was pounding painfully. All the men in the James family had bad hearts that would get them someday. So he drank a bit more of the Cardew to give him time to think. No, He couldn't believe that Holmes would have told anyone about James's presence in the cemetery and in Clover's tomb sculpture interior. He'd promised that he wouldn't.
What is a promise to a man who is not really a gentleman?
Why, John? He said softly. Surely I spent enough time here as your guest that you must welcome the quiet household after our disruption.
You were here with Holmes, said Hay. Or here when Holmes was impersonating that Norwegian explorer, Jan Sigurdsson, which was enjoyable in its own way. But Clara and I felt that we never really had a chance to talk to you.
James set his chin on his chest in a posture that would, half a century later, come to be called Churchillian.
Unless,
continued Hay, leaning far back in his chair now and drinking the whiskey almost hurriedly, as if enjoying its fragrance weren't part of the process of enjoying it.
Unless you plan to leave the city soon, to Cambridge, perhaps then on to England, Paris?
No, I have no immediate plans to leave.
James realized that he'd decided that even as he spoke the words.
But my room at Mrs. Stevens's is quite adequate.
Hay grinned beneath his carefully trimmed whiskers.
Adequate for a bachelor junior congressman, perhaps, Harry, but certainly not for a writer. You are doing some writing, aren't you?
Too little, thought James.
But then, the plan had been to commit suicide in Paris, and part of the attractiveness of that plan had been to end all the deadlines, to getting his agent and stage producers and publishers and everyone else with their baby beaks wide open and waiting to be fed to, how did the Americans put it? To then get off his neck.
Some very modest attempts at my next play, said James, his tone as doleful as his countenance. Little more than notes.
Hay grinned again.
I trust that your room was comfortable when you and Holmes were staying here, but we have a much larger suite of guest rooms at the far end of the wing opposite to the one where you stayed before. We didn't place you there during your last stay because it's inconveniently far from the main stairway. But if you'd honor us with another visit, that suite will be yours. Bedroom and much larger sitting room, both with fireplaces, of course. The sitting room with its own rather pleasant library. The colored tiles around the large bathtub are somewhat brighter than those in your former bathroom, but the wash basins are marble, the taps are silver, and I can promise you that the water will be hot as well as cold.
James took a breath, trying to frame his refusal in the politest way possible. In truth, it was the proximity to Henry Adams, the man whose secrecy he'd so callously invaded, that was preventing him from saying yes.
And as nice as Mrs. Stevens's little place is, continued Hay, the whiskey gone from his glass, I don't believe that she can provide you with as excellent a manservant as we can.
Manservant,
James repeated, feeling strangely numb all over.
Is this the way a character in a novel feels when the author is manipulating him or her in a way contrary to their nature or to common sense?
He wished he could ask Holmes that question, and actually patted the jacket pocket where his purse held the detective's card with the name and address of the cigar store where James could get in contact with him.
Yes, and not just any manservant, said Hay, leaning further over the desk now, but Gregory, one of our longest-serving and most trusted employees.
James remembered a tall, white-haired man on Hay's staff being referred to as Gregory. The servant had emanated dignity and quiet efficiency.
Is Gregory his first or last name? Asked James.
Last, said Hay. I believe his Christian name is Terence. Gregory is not only the perfect man to stoke up your fires and lay out your clothes in the morning, but he gives the best and closest neck shaves of any man on the staff.
I really have a powerful reluctance to being in your and Clara's way once again, began James.
Hay held his hands up, palms forward, and then moved them quickly in opposite directions as if opening a door or brushing something aside.
This shan't be like your first visit,
where you were a guest with a guest's, well, one might call them obligations, coming down to dinner with us, making small talk, joining me for luncheon, and so forth. No, the guest suite would be yours. It's on the northeast corner, and there will be some light traffic noise coming through the windows there, but it's very soft noise. Our boy Dell lived in those rooms for a while, but went back to his own before going back to school. He thought the suite was too quiet, too large. Perhaps the rooms in the suite are haunted, thought James. He smiled as he realized that he wouldn't be averse to a few ectoplasmic visitations. Perhaps his sister Alice could advise him as to what to do with her ashes that he'd pilfered. And daily service from the maids, of course, but only when you're out. Hay was going on. And you can have all your meals and tea breaks in your room if you like. Gregory will be your guard at the gate, as well as your valet. And of course, you shall have your own key to the front door so you can come and go whenever you want, without disturbing anyone.
I confess that I have found myself a trifle lonely at Mrs. Stevens's place, said James, already surrendering himself to the invitation. He could rest. He could write.
No wonder you do, especially with Mr. Holmes leaving so abruptly, said Hay.
The statesman did not seem to notice the minor levitation of James's eyebrows.
You agree then, Harry?
James nodded.
Wonderful, cried Hay. I'll have some of the lads go over now in the wagon to fetch your steamer trunk and other luggage.
A minute later, they were standing just inside the open door, watching the spring rain fall and enjoying the scent of the rain on new grass and fresh leaves when Hay's brougham was brought around for James. The manservant Gregory was up on the box next to the driver and sheltering under a red umbrella. And then came the good-natured stablemen, wool and leather caps beaded with raindrops, driving the flatbed wagon for his luggage. James said,
John, how did you know that Holmes had moved out? It happened only this morning.
Hay grinned and clapped the author on his right shoulder, opening an umbrella at the same time to escort James into the brougham.
Harry, Harry, one must never underestimate the speed with which even the smallest news travels in Washington City, especially around Lafayette Park. Your landlady's daughter, slow as the poor girl is, gave all the details of Holmes to our footman at the morning outdoor market, probably before either of us was up and dressed.
James settled into the sweet-smelling leather of the covered brougham. Hay folded the umbrella and tapped the box with the wooden handle.
See you soon, Harry.
James rode in silence for the few blocks. The daughter telling the footman about Holmes's early departure, who then mentioned it to other servants, who were then overheard by Clara or John, made all the sense in the world. But Henry James did not believe it. 9. We get lots of cyclists buying lemon squeezers. All in all, Sherlock Holmes had enjoyed an enjoyably productive birthday morning. At home, or at what he still thought of as home in his former digs on Baker Street in London, he'd often sleep in until 11 a.m. or later during those dull periods between cases. And then he'd often have breakfast and return to bed. Of course, the mixture of cocaine he injected during those dull times added to the lethargy, something this new heroic drug he was injecting himself with in the States didn't seem to do. But then he was always especially alert when he was on a case. This particular morning of April 4th, he'd wakened at dawn and gone out to find himself a new place to live, the same old Kirkwood House Hotel at the corner of 12th Street Northwest and Pennsylvania Avenue that he and James had passed the night before. Rumors still persisted that the old hotel would be torn down almost any month, but the place had a comfortable lived-in quality that Holmes approved of. Expensive drapes, but faded from sunlight, marvelously well-made chairs showing wear that even antimacassars could not hide. A combination of attentive service mixed with the discretion of knowing when to leave its guests to their own devices. Holmes understood why the more successful traveling salesmen were still loyal to the place. He hired three reliable men, vouched for by the manager of the Kirkwood House, since one of the men was the manager's son, and their wagon to fetch his packed bags and steamer trunks from Mrs. Stevens' boarding house without making a fuss. Then, with the shops just opening, Holmes had bought himself a pistol. He'd noticed the generous number of gun shops around Washington and entered the one closest to the Kirkwood house a minute after the store opened. There was a vast array of pistols under glass, some of them evidently designed for cowboy desperados, and more hanging on the wall. The air smelled rather pleasantly of steel and gun oil.
"May I help you, sir?"
the mustached clerk asked.
"Do you have any new lemon squeezers for sale?"
said Holmes.
"Yes, sir, absolutely, sir.
Which barrel length? 2 inches or 3?"
3. "Yes, better accuracy with the 3-inch barrel, sir,"
said the clerk as he opened the glass case and removed the weapon.
"Yes, with a 3-inch barrel, I might be able to hit the wall of a barn if I were inside the barn firing from close range," thought Holmes. "Maybe."
"Any caliber you prefer, sir?"
"38S and W caliber," said Holmes.
"It also comes in .32, sir. A bit less expensive and a tad lighter."
"The 38, please," Holmes said firmly.
The clerk ceremoniously displayed the small pistol, and it was smaller than the vast majority of the revolvers in the store, and snapped the cylinder open to show his client that the weapon was unloaded, then handed it to Holmes. Holmes noticed that 38 S&W cartridges would be a tight fit in the chambers, and then he snapped shut the cylinder and held the weapon at arm's length, aiming at the brick wall at the back of the store.
"One squeezes the grip as well as the trigger," said the clerk.
"Yes," said Holmes.
He dry-fired the pistol twice. Not a good practice overall, but necessary to get used to a new revolver.
"You like the hammerless lemon squeezers then, sir? You a bicyclist by any chance?"
"Exactly," said Holmes. "Wouldn't do to snag a hammer and have the pistol go off in my trouser pocket now, would it?"
"No, sir. We get lots of cyclists buying lemon squeezers. Most popular. These pistols are guaranteed not to fire if one takes a fall while cycling."
The clerk paused and cleared his throat.
"Are you a bicycle fanatic then, sir?"
"Quite so," said Holmes. "Absolutely mad about it."
"Not too many customers